This week's portion is called Re'e. And it starts out with a very, very surprising line. Because, you know, certain things are self-evident. And I would think that anything which is so self-evident, I don't need a higher power or a deity or a legislature to come and tell me this is what I need to do. Which means, I guess when my wife gets frustrated with some of my kids who seem not to be able to do anything for themselves, she'll say, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, just like to get them going. And then if you're lucky, okay, now clean your room. But like it never gets that far. But you don't need a legislation to tell you to breathe. Unless you're a frustrated mother, then you need to tell your kids. But over here, the first verse in this portion says, Re'e anochi nosein lefnechem hayom. Re'e means look, see. I place before you today bracha uklala, a blessing and a curse. And it goes on to say the blessing will take place if you follow the way of God and so on, and the curse will take place if you deviate from God's path. Along the way, it will eventually give us very, very good advice, and that advice will be to choose the blessing. Now, let me ask you something. If you had two choices placed in front of you, one was a blessing and one was a curse, how many of you would say, I'll have the curse, please? You know, can I have two? No, that's not what's going to happen. Any person who has the least bit of intelligence will say, I would like the blessing. So if these are the two paths, this should really be very, very simple. Later on, a number of chapters down the line, it goes on to say that I place two things in front of you, and it reiterates this thing about the blessing and the curse, although it changes it ever so slightly. And the second time when it comes back, it says, I place in front of you the blessing and the curse. I place in front of you two paths. One is life and one is death. Choose life. And if anything, that just magnifies the issue. Because again, would you choose a curse over a blessing? For that matter, would you choose death over life? I think that for most people, can you close that door as you go? Close that. Yeah. I think for most people, if somebody chooses death under normal circumstances, it's going to be indication that there is some type of instability going on. And yes, I understand there are times where people's life gets so crazy, or for that matter, gets so painful that they just don't want to live. I understand that. But that means that there's something which is fundamentally wrong. Under normal circumstances, every single one of us have a very, very strong drive, and that drive is a drive to live. We want to live. We want life. I mean, you talk about the hierarchy of human need. That's one of the most basic needs, the need for survival, the need to live. Although it's interesting that on a psychological level, Freud, for that matter, the Talmud as well, identify something which is called a death wish. And these two drives seem to be, you know, going directly against one another. One is a drive to live and the other is a drive to not to live. And the question is, where does this come from? What is this a manifestation of? Or maybe let me put this a little differently. If the choices are life and death, I don't believe very many of us are going to choose death. Again, all things equal. We're not going to choose death. We're going to choose life. We want to live. We want to live. And again, I'll qualify this last time. Unless our lives are so incredibly painful, we will choose life. Even my coffee or everything. So what is it that causes us to go in the other direction? What is it that causes us not to choose life? And the answer, I think, is very, very simple. The answer is, if you go all the way back to the beginning of creation, you go all the way back to the beginning of Genesis, God places us in the Garden of Eden. And in the Garden of Eden, he placed before us a number of different choices. He placed in front of us two trees, if you will. One is the tree of life. And by the way, stop right there a second. realize now that we have a choice here between life and death, between a blessing and a curse. In the Garden of Eden, there is a tree of life. And on the other hand, there's a tree. And that becomes very interesting, because what is the opposite of a tree of life? Yeah, but you know what answer I want to hear when I say, what's the opposite? A tree of death. By the way, if you called it a tree of death, would anybody go for it?
No.
So what do you need?
You need to mask it.
You need to mask it. You need
PR team.
Exactly. And who was the one who was in charge of the PR team?
The serpent.
The snake is the one. The serpent is the one who does the packaging, who does the sales for it. I hope none of you are salesmen or salespeople. Don't want to insult you more than necessary, but think how clear it is. One tree is called the tree of life, another tree is called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But what does God say will happen when you partake of that tree? The day you eat from the tree, you will die. So what is that a tree of?
Yeah.
The tree of death. So now go back again. What do you have in the Garden of Eden? You have a tree of knowledge. Well, let's make it simpler. You have a tree of life and a tree of death. And I asked you from the beginning, who would ever choose death? Well, guess what? Adam and Eve did. Why did they choose death? Because they didn't see it as death, because it was repackaged. You're not going to put up a skull and bones on the tree over there and say tree of death. What are you going to call it? You're going to have to repackage it and get a better name for it. You're going to have to call it something a little bit better, which will make people want to buy it. Right? Aren't there a lot of people making a lot of money today getting people to buy things which are really, really bad for them? Okay? And it's interesting, because you would think that maybe that's just part of capitalism. It's part of the modern world. And when you realize that this is just so simple, and it goes all the way back to the first day that man walked on this earth, it hasn't changed. But what becomes fascinating is that the choices are so simple. The difficulty for us is to be able to identify it. The difficulty for us is to know, or if I put it in a little different terms, what is it that will make you want to partake of a tree of death when you have a serpent whispering in your ear telling you how good it's going to be for you? That's where the problem is. On a logical level, if we can be logical, if we can try to be logical. By the way, do you remember what exactly it is that the serpent says to Eve? You will be like God. Now, if I were to tell you that there's a fruit, or there's a pill, or there's a shot, or there's a line that you can sniff, or anything else that you may do, that if you take this, you'll be like God, what should you tell me? No. You are not merely an apple away from God. It's not like the only thing that you're missing right now is you're missing one fruit. You're missing one pill. You're missing one whatever else it is. You're not. Which means right there is a lie. Right there is where the lie takes place. Which means man on his own would not choose death. But man will choose death if death gets disguised as something other than death. At that point, it becomes very, very enticing, if not intoxicating. And that's really our problem. That's exactly what's laid out in front of us. See, I've placed before you a blessing and a curse. Later on, see, I've placed before you life and death. Choose life. The question is, how do we regain the ability to be able to identify what is life and what is death, what is a blessing, what is a curse? Because the problem is, and this is something that we also have to focus on, that other tree, which I've already called the tree of death. Okay, what did you want to call it before? You had a nicer name for it.
Tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Right. The tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now the question is, what exactly does that mean? Tree of knowledge of good and evil, so we have a couple of problems there. You need to define what is knowledge, and what does it mean good and evil? Because I can understand good, I understand evil. What does it mean, good and evil? What does it mean, knowledge of good and evil? Matter of fact, what was the difference between Adam and Eve prior to partaking of the tree of good and knowledge of good and evil to afterwards? How exactly does it impact them? What does it do to them? The answer is that eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil creates confusion. It creates confusion because it creates a combination of good and evil where they get confused, whereby partaking of this tree, which is what leads to death, is now you have a world where you can no longer clearly see what is good and what is evil. Which means the irony over here is that they had a choice. What was the choice? Life and death. And what happens when you choose death? Now you have more and more death because now you have more and more confusion. If what I just said is not completely clear, I'll try to clarify it as I go on. Maybe you need to go back a step. One step is, what does knowledge mean? But the step before that, what is a serpent? That itself is incredibly difficult for us to understand. Let me point something out. The last verse in chapter 2 of Genesis is a beautiful verse. It's on page 14 or 15. It's a beautiful verse. After man, Adam, has been by himself, has been all alone, has not found a soulmate, has not found a companion, all that he found was loneliness. Loneliness by virtue of being the only man where everything else was animals, where no one understood him. There was no one for him to talk to. There was no communication. He's all alone. Which, by the way, is also something which people can, I believe, identify with today. There are many people who can be in a room full of many other people but feel completely alone. It's not a question. It's not a numbers game. It's an existential issue. That the person just doesn't feel a connection with anyone else, that's going to be a problem. Adam is all alone, and God gives him a soulmate. The description of Adam being divided in half or having a piece taken from him, depending how one understands that, is saying that here is the other part of him. And the spiritual concept of a soulmate is that there's two parts of a soul. One whole soul is divided into two parts, and the soulmate is the other part of the whole. The connotation over here is in this verse that we're about to read, is that when man and woman, when Adam and Eve, when they join together physically, sexually, after having been separated from one another, that is a return, which means that is a physical expression of a spiritual state. I don't know why I have to work so hard to describe what sexuality is supposed to be, but perhaps I have to work so hard because we live in a world where that's just not the case. We live in a world where, you know, instead of what I just now described as a physical expression of a spiritual state, what has taken the place of that is what I guess most of you would call hooking up. And hooking up is not what this is being described over here. It says, and the two of them were naked. Excuse me, the verse before says, therefore, a man should leave his father and mother. Vidavak biishto. The word davak is a wonderful word. The word davak means cling. Man should cling to his wife. Vahayula basar echad. They should become of one flesh. There's a term which is used in Hasidic writings called dveikus. Dveikus means to cling to God, to be one with, where one's soul, as it were, soars out of the body and is able to cling to God. This is like deep meditation, to be able to totally connect to God on a spiritual level. That is the term. The source for that term is what's being described over here between Adam and Eve, that Adam and Eve should cling to one another, davak. Man should cling to his wife, and they should become of one flesh. And that's what I said a moment ago, that the becoming of one flesh is an expression of the spiritual state. And the two of them were naked. V'yushneim arumim. The two of them were naked. Ha'adam v'ishto, man and his wife. V'lo yidboshishu. But they were not embarrassed. Why weren't they embarrassed?
Why should they be embarrassed?
That's true. So if you would take off your clothes right now, you would be embarrassed?
No, it's not.
Maybe slightly. Why?
Yeah,
why?
That's one too.
But why?
Because now it's after the sin of the...
Exactly. Exactly. Which means that partaking from the tree...
Yeah, it's different. I mean, this is not going to be in front of people. Yeah, that once they get married, then it'll be different, I think.
But you correctly pointed out that when it says that they eat from the tree, what happens next? They start to cover themselves up. Why? Because now they're embarrassed. Why? Because now they live in a world where good and evil are confused. And good and evil are confused, things have changed completely. Let me, again, try to explain this a little bit more. There's a very, very interesting wordplay that takes place in the next verse. Over here it says the two of them were erumim. Erumim means naked. The next verse says, and the serpent, the hanachash, haya arum mikol chayata sadeh. And the nachash was, over here the word arum means sly. It was slyer, if that's a word, than any of the other animals in the field. But you know what's fascinating? It's the same word as naked. It can also be understood that the serpent was nakeder than anyone else, but of course it's meaningless. Unless, of course, you remember that snakes lose their skin. The snake was more naked than anyone else. I'm not sure how far to go into this analysis and how much time we have today and how much I can confuse you today. But I also have little question that what we have over here is a contrast. We have innocent Adam and Eve before partaking from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What they should have done, of course, is to go straight for the tree of life, which we don't know what that means right now either. That's what they should have done. Instead, they take from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Why do they do? Because the serpent gets them to do it. The serpent says you'll be like God, which is ridiculous. Actually, how do you really become like God? How do you really become like God?
By creating.
By creating, you'd be like God. How else can you be like God? By emulating God. The question is, how can you know how to emulate God? So leave that as an open question for the moment. One part of me tells me that this serpent represents something which is very different. This serpent represents, you know, if this were a class in psychology, I would say without any hesitation, the serpent is a phallic symbol. It represents sexuality. As a matter of fact, after speaking to Eve for a moment, it says that Eve then sees the tree, and she sees it in lustful terms. She sees, and the word lust is used for the first time. You know what a tree of knowledge of good and evil causes? It causes confusion on the most basic things. You know, in life, there are certain things that are very, very closely related to one another. They're so close that you can confuse one for the other, but they're not exactly the same. I'll give you an example. The word which is used, which the serpent builds up within Eve, is the word lust. Ta'avala inayim, lust. Lust and sensuality are very closely related. They're not identical. I would say that Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, before eating from the tree of knowledge, there's a great deal of sensuality to that. But that's not exactly lust. The sexual interface, this meeting between Adam and Eve, is described as a meeting of two souls, of souls coming together, bodies coming together. What the serpent seems to be selling is the physical action devoid of the spiritual content. That, by the way, is what happens when good and evil get confused.
So is it possible also with the word arumim and arum that they're the same word? Because maybe instead of naked, it could mean innocent, and cunning would kind of be the opposite of that.
I think you're onto something. I think you're on something. One of the commentators points in that direction, but correct, that's where I was leading with that, because at least you have to realize there's a contrast over there. You have this cunning serpent versus this innocent couple. And of course, after the interaction takes place, now the innocent couple loses their innocence. And that's the tragedy. Now I'll ask you again, how does that take place? How does somebody choose a tree of death over a tree of life? So the answer is, they never... Let's put the things together. A, they don't see it as a tree of death. What do they see it of? A tree of knowledge of good and evil. And what else is there now? Now there's another component to it. What's the other component? The other component is lust. And when there's lust involved in the equation, then how can a person possibly think clearly? Which means this result of a tree of knowledge of good and evil combined together with lust has taken the place of our pure, innocent, sensual, spiritual Adam and Eve prior to the sin. And then you think about how much the world has changed between the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. The world has changed completely. Let me jump back to this week's portion for a second. There is a major theme that goes through the whole portion. And that is, it speaks of a place that has eventually become a central place in Judaism, but we were lacking a term for it. Right at the very beginning of this week's portion, it talks about that when you come to Israel, get rid of the places of idolatry. And then it talks about bringing your offerings, instead of the places of idolatry, to bring them in front of God. And it speaks specifically about a place, there's this one place that you should get to. And what is this place? This is what we would later on call the temple. L'shichnot tidrishu v'vasashama. Excuse me? It speaks about going to a place which we eventually call the temple. The theme of the temple in this week's portion, if you get a chance to look at it, you realize that it's a minor theme going all the way through from one end to the other. It keeps coming back to the temple. It's not a discussion about the temple, but it keeps coming back to it. What is the temple? A temple is a place where God is manifest. A temple is a place where you serve God. A temple is the place that somebody's supposed to connect to God. If you really think about this, you realize that prior to the temple, there was another place that man was able to connect to God. Prior to the temple, there was another place that God was manifest. And what is that place? The Garden of Eden. The problem with the Garden of Eden is that man gets expelled from the Garden of Eden. Now, what we seem therefore to realize now is that these two choices of life and death, which seem like such simple things, is not all that simple because of the way that things are packaged. Let's go back to two more points. And the two more points will lead us to, again, basic understanding. We still don't know what knowledge is, and we still don't know what the tree of life is. Let's start with the tree of life. There's a verse in Proverbs, and let's be honest and let's be humble. I can give you all kinds of interpretations, but if I have an interpretation based upon what a verse says, what a prophet says, the prophet's interpretation will be better than my interpretation, and that's without any false modesty. I can now guess what I think the word or the term tree of life means, but we're told in Proverbs, it says the Torah is a tree of life to those who embrace it. Etz Chaim hi l'machzikim bo. The Torah is a tree of life to those who embrace it, which is for that reason, you know the wood on the Torah scroll itself? That's called Etz Chaim. On many, many, in many, many synagogues, on the ark it will say Etz Chaim, because the verse describes the Etz Chaim, the tree of life, as being Torah. Now, if the tree of life is Torah, then what exactly is a tree of knowledge? I remember years ago, I got an email from somebody who I'd never met. This At this point, it's a fairly common occurrence. But I got a question from somebody who wrote me a letter, and it could be they had read something that I'd written, and she said that her brother didn't want to be an observant Jew because Judaism was so anti-intellectual. So I wrote back to, in what ways Judaism is anti-intellectual? So her brother said, take a look, it says that one is not supposed to partake of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Actually, he didn't call it of good and evil, he said the tree of knowledge. Judaism is against knowledge, Judaism is anti-intellectual. Okay, that was his question, that was his understanding, that was his reading of it. Now, what's unfortunate in that understanding? He thinks that the tree of knowledge of good and evil, what he thinks that tree is one of intellectual pursuit. And I'm saying, again, we're missing the point. It is a tree that causes confusion between good and evil, of not knowing where the line is drawn between what is good and what is evil. It's not... You know what? Let's go back one more step. In English, there are different terms that we use almost interchangeably. Wisdom, knowledge, understanding. Are those all the same? What's the difference in wisdom, knowledge, and understanding?
Knowledge is just like dry facts, like logical facts.
Okay.
Wisdom is what you do with it.
Okay.
Understanding can be of merely a simple issue. Knowledge, you would think automatically of a person who may have a wealth of knowledge on a specific subject.
In Kabbalistic literature, these terms, chachma, bina, vidas. By the way, the movement called Chabad chose its name because of those three terms, Chachma, Bina, and Das. Chabad stands for Chachma, Bina, and Das. And they believe that they are trying to create some kind of a harmony between these different things. The tree of knowledge and good evil, which term is not used in knowledge? It's Das. It's not Chachma. It's not wisdom. It's not Bina. Bina is understanding. According to Talmudic and mystical literature, when it comes to Bina, women, it says, have superior Bina than men, superior understanding than men. I think in the modern world, you would call that woman's intuition. Father, what does that mean? What does it mean, woman's intuition? I don't know, should I pick on the women in the room to tell me what it means? So do women really have better sense than men? They have better instincts.
Not generally. I think there are some men that have access to their intuition.
So the question is, what is this? And by the way, it says that women, when it comes to das, their das is weaker. Their das is weaker, but their bina is yisera. The das is kal, is light, and the bina is yeter, yisera, is more. What does that mean? See, on the one hand, if I were incredibly superficial, I can say, well, look how sexist this is. I don't believe it's dealing with sexism. I believe it's dealing with something which is much more profound. I think what it's telling us, I can have somebody... Let me put it this way. There's different ways to weigh information. I can weigh information based upon a purely intellectual process, or I can weigh information based how I feel about that information. Those are different ways of approaching the exact same thing. When it says that a woman has greater intuition, what it means is that she trusts her intuition more. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that the mind is different. It means that there is a greater emphasis placed on intuition. And by the way, this is, of course, one of the many reasons that men and women, when they try to communicate, have a difficult time. And it's also one of the many reasons why, when they do succeed in communicating, their lives are so enhanced by the other one, because there are different ways of looking at the world. Do you look at the hard facts and compute them? Or do you feel about how, you know, it really all comes together? It's different ways of looking at it. But it's very interesting, because it says that when it comes to das, the das is weaker. which leads us back to the, what does the word das mean? The word das means knowledge. The word das is the Eitz HaDas Tovara, the book of knowledge of good and evil. So what is das? According to Kabbalistic literature, Chachma is a male attribute, Bina is a feminine attribute, and Da'as is the interaction between the two. Now, by being the interaction, first of all, let me try to show you this on a simpler level. What is the first verse immediately after Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden? What is the next verse, what does it say? Beginning of chapter 4, what? And Adam knew, right. So, Adam, what does it mean that Adam and Eve knew each other? Adam knew his wife. So that's where they get that famous line, he knew her in the biblical sense. What does that mean? It means they experienced one another. There was intimacy, correct. Now that's very interesting because it says that women's intimacy, what does it mean? Women's intimacy is lower than man's intimacy? That doesn't make any sense. But it says women's bina is yisera. What is bina? Bina is feeling something deeper. It means that a woman's capacity for emotional love is going to be greater than a man's capacity for emotional love. But when it comes to das, and what is das? Das is the sexual act. Over there, it seems to be saying that women will be putting less credence on the sexual act. Now, this doesn't mean that men like sex more than women like sex. That's not what it means. It goes down to emphasis, by how much you're going to put emphasis on each particular thing, which means there's an old adage, and who knows what's true today? We live in a very messed up world. There's an old adage that a man will claim that he loves someone in order to get sex, and that a woman would give sex in order to get someone to love them. That's exactly what I'm saying. Which means, do you put your emphasis on the intuition, on the emotion, on the feeling, or do you put your emphasis on the das, which is the physical interaction? The tree of knowledge and good and evil is a tree that allows you to understand things based upon experience. By the way, that sounds very good. It doesn't get more real than experience. The problem is what kind of experiences you have, which means every single one of us are scarred by our experiences, which means the various experiences that we've had have not been controlled laboratory experiments. Every single one of us bump into things in our lives, sometimes before we should, sometimes after we should. The timing is not always perfect, and we just sort of bump on from experience to experience to experience. That's what our lives are. Based upon the context of any particular experience, it will determine and how you have your orientation to that particular thing, perhaps for years and years to come, or unless you get major therapy. You have no idea what I'm talking about. Let me give you the simplest example of this. And this will go back to how knowledge and wisdom need really to be oriented to one another. Have any of you ever tasted some really, really fine wine? Really, really good wine. Now, if you gave that really good wine to a 14-year-old, would you be wasting your time and wasting your money and wasting your wine? Why?
You have to cultivate tastes.
You have to cultivate tastes. Which means the experience without the knowledge is not going to work. And if the kid for the first time tastes wine, it says, that's disgusting, which would normally be the reaction because they have no idea how to drink it, how it's supposed to taste, about why, nothing about it. They'll taste and say, that's terrible. Which means you put two bottles of wine for them. One is sweet, kiddish wine, and the other is very, very fine wine. They'll choose the kiddish wine because at least it's a little sweet. Because it will remind them in some bizarre way to Coca-Cola or to something which they're more familiar with. Now, if you say to somebody who really knows wine that this person chose Coca-Cola over a $500 bottle of wine, you say, what, are they out of their minds? But that's because they had experience without really understanding. When you jump into experience with that understanding, you create a very warped sense of the world. That's what happened in the Garden of Eden. What is the tree of knowledge? The tree of knowledge is a world of experience where you jump into experience without having proper context. Sometimes it's very enticing, but as enticing as it is, it can also be terribly self-destructive. On the other hand, what is the tree of life? The tree of life is described, as I said before, as Torah. It is the wisdom or the understanding in order to put the experience into context. If we now try to put all this back into the proper sequence, in the Garden of Eden, and this may come as a surprise to you, but the commentaries say what Adam was supposed to do was first eat from the tree of life, and then he could approach the tree of knowledge. Right, right. But first you take from the tree of life. Of course, if you take from the tree of life, you live forever. Yeah. You take from the tree of life, now you have the antidote to the problem of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now death can't come into the world. That's what's supposed to happen. But instead, the sequence is changed. But when the sequence is changed, then it's like that 14-year-old drinking that expensive wine and say, I never want to drink wine again because that wine is terrible. Or having just a warped sense of what it is.
So it's, in essence, we're almost talking about like a rejection of Torah?
In a conceptual manner. Correct, correct. Again, you're correct, but we just have to really break things down to the core sense. Which means, now we go back to really what we're up to. The Jewish people stood by Sinai. They received the Torah. They accepted the Torah. They're about to march into the land of Israel. They're about to build the temple. The temple is a place that God is going to be manifest. And at this point, Moses is warning them, you have placed in front of you a blessing and a curse. You have placed in front of you life and death. Choose life. And again, I can ask you, the same way that I asked in the beginning, how in the world will anybody ever want to choose death over life, a curse over a blessing? The problem is that's what mankind has been doing from the very first day. And when you want to understand why, because we like our experiences, we like superficiality. The lust aspect of it, I think, is definitely a component. But you put all of these things together, and people end up having a death wish, choosing superficiality, ultimately choosing death. And the antidote for all that seems to be something which is very simple. Choose life. Choosing life means choose a blessing. Choosing a blessing means understand or obtain wisdom. In this context means learn Torah, live Torah, follow Torah, and use that as the guideline for when and how to experience all the experiences, all the varieties of experience which man has open to them. The problem is if you go about it the other way around, what you'll end up having is this wonderful big confusion of good and evil all thrown together, and that confusion leads you to a state that you no longer even know what is right and what is wrong because you just base yourself on how things feel rather on things being fundamentally right or fundamentally wrong. And once you approach things in the wrong order, you get stuck in a spiritual quagmire which is almost impossible to extricate oneself from. That's what it means by choose life. That is the idea. That's what it means to choose the blessing. That's the choice that man had at the very beginning of time. And as I said, people make mistakes in terms of the choices they make because we're unable to see how dangerous the bad choice is. It gets repackaged. It gets sold to us in a seductive manner. You got a great PR firm working for the other side, and it makes things very, very confusing. God should give us all the insight to be able to identify what is good and what is wrong, and God should give us strength to make the right choices. Have a good Shabbos.
I have a question.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Please.
Yeah, well, what are you talking about, man? The next verse, talking about how you choose the curse.
Yeah.
And saying, you know, even though these